This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. Republicans once claimed to stand for free trade, a welcoming posture toward immigrants and low spending. The policies of the de facto leader of today's GOP openly rejects these ideas, and yet a Republican-led Congress has acquiesced. So do they deserve to get walloped in the upcoming election? Outgoing South Carolina Republican Congressman Mark Sanford spoke with me on Friday. I read recently that the president has demanded 5% spending cuts from each of his agencies, which seems odd when those agencies don't really control the purse strings. Why is Congress so acquiescent when it comes to massive spending?
Congress is acquiescent on spending because that's the nature of Congress. A dollar that comes into Washington is going to get spent, period. It's just a question of where. And so I think that, you know, you have sort of an unholy alliance between a Congress that, that by its very nature has a bias towards spending more, an absence of leadership at the presidential level. I admire the fact that the president would say, hey, let's look at our agencies and let's look at how we trim down by 5%. But those are pennies on the dollars, because if you look at the real spending problem that we have as a country, it's tied to entitlement spending, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest. And so it's the 80-20 rule of life. And what the administration has said, what the president has said, is we're not going to touch entitlements, but here let's come up with 5% cuts on these areas of domestic discretionary. So it's nice, but it's symbolic. And then the third part of what I think suggests that we have a profound problem with regard to spending in Washington is the fact that there really hasn't been leadership on this subject. And so it requires presidential leadership. If you go back to the Bowles-Simpson Commission, you look at a lot of different commissions which have been fundamentally punts by both the Congress and the executive branch. What people said, well, we'll get this commission to look at it. They'll come up with some. But fundamentally, in Washington, it compared to any other time that I've seen over my 20-plus years involved in public policy, I see less attention and less conversation about debt, deficit, and government spending than at any other point in my time in political life.
So I have heard that when somebody talks about cutting spending in Congress, the atypical response, or should say not atypical response, is, well, are interest rates going up? And that seems to be what will be the thing, the only thing possibly to trigger any kind of substantive evaluation of spending priorities in Congress.
I agree with that. I mean, Roosevelt was once credited with saying, the beauty of the American political system is that it always does the right thing, comma, after it's exhausted every other possible remedy. And I think this holds true particularly with regard to spending. I think it's tragically going to take a burning platform to create the kind of change that I think is necessary to really bend the spending trajectory that we're on right now. I think that that's going to be incredibly painful for a lot of people across this country in terms of future interest rates, in terms of the value of the dollar, ultimately in terms of the American way of life. But that's the storm that's coming, given the way that everybody in Washington seems to be punting on this issue. And I can't say everybody. I got to single out people like Justin Amash and a handful of others that I think really have walked the walk. But there's surprisingly few walking the walk on spending in Washington these days.
Nobel Peace Laureate Barack Obama sure did order the killing of a lot of people, some of whom were American citizens in countries that we weren't officially fighting. He dropped a lot of bombs in 2016, at least. He dropped 26,000 bombs. Many of those were in countries that we weren't officially fighting. And nothing has changed since then with respect to war powers. And, I have this vain hope, I suppose, that that leaders of the left and right will get together and decide that, yes, in fact, James Madison was correct and that the powers to conduct war ought to be fully vested in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, the founding fathers were crystal clear. They knew that body bags don't come back to Washington, D.C. They come back to congressional districts across this country. And as a consequence, they were absolutely deliberate in being very clearly stating that war powers rested in the Congress.
Is there any appetite or any move to try to restrict war powers at this time?
Not really. And so, again, I'd single out some heroes, the Justin Mamashas, the Thomas Massies, and Walter Jones of the world on the Republican side. And frankly, there are an equal number of Democrats as well that have worked hard on this. But again, it's not in vogue. And I think that it's another example of the way in which Congress has ceded too much power and authority to the executive branch. Too much power and authority to the courts because at times they haven't wanted to deal with prickly issues. And the issue of death and war is a prickly issue.
Trade is another prickly issue. And there seems to be no end to the tariff hikes that this administration is willing to put out there on countries that, frankly, we should have powerful trading relationships with, including Canada and Mexico. So despite the fact that we have a new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, it's not great. Is there any hope that you see in the near term on getting back to some normalcy and some regularity with respect to trade?
Not with this administration. I've been outspoken in my criticism of this administration on the trade front. I mean, the idea that Canada is somehow a strategic threat, therefore we're going to slap steel tariffs on them, is just bizarre. But what you see is an administration that's prided itself on deregulation enacting more regulation, because tariffs, not only are they taxes, but they're regulation. It is government control of the flow of goods and services rather than the free market and Adam Smith's invisible hand. And so I just think it's troubling at a variety of different levels in terms of the message it sends to allies, in terms of the increasing regulation and power of a federal government over each one of our lives, and obviously the consequence, which is higher cost for all of us, which is, again, the tax part that everybody leaves out. But if you talk to, you know, Leitinger and you talk to, you know, other folks in the administration, they are locked down on their position. I think it's a mistaken one, but it is where they are.
All right. So what do you expect to happen in these midterm elections in November?
I don't really have a crystal ball. I mean, certainly the conventional wisdom is that Republicans will lose more than a fair number of seats in the House side.
Should they? Let's be real here. Should Republicans lose a bunch of seats?
I wouldn't say they should, but what I'd say is it's certainly the natural order of things for the party in power. But I would say we've squandered some opportunities, particularly on the spending front. I mean, Paul Ryan, to his credit, was a budget hawk and a budget expert going into the speakership. I wish that he had been able to push more of the budget and spending issue than I think was the case. And as a consequence, it was a squandered opportunity by Republicans. And I think that there are a number of other fronts wherein we've been acquiescent to the administration, though it has wandered off on populist fronts, not liberty-based fronts, that ultimately limit the size and scope of the federal government and its authority over each one of our lives.
So maybe you know that Republicans deserve to lose those seats, but maybe they won't?
I'm not saying that. I'm going to leave it to the good Lord and the voters out there decide what's going to happen next in terms of each individual's congressional district.
All right. So you've been an outspoken person on behalf of allowing Americans to travel to Cuba. Jeff Flake has said I think I recall him saying something to the effect of, if somebody's going to keep me out of a country, it better be a communist. And but, you know, we have lots of people who want to come to the United States. The president has treated immigration specifically as an issue that I don't know. I guess it's like he treats trade, a zero-sum game. That is, people who come to this country are net costs. They are not net benefits.
I'm a free trader, so I believe in the free flow of capital and I believe ultimately in the free flow of labor. within the confines of law. And so I think that the president has been right in saying we ought to know who's here and why they're here. We ought to have a real accounting on that front. You can't have an open border. It ought to be a regulated border. But we had a program called the Vocero program back from 1946 to 1964 that allowed immigrant labor to come in, work on produce fields, and then they went home. They didn't have American citizenship. They added to the workforce, but ultimately labor union shut them down. And so, you know, the irony here is that we have this sort of no man's land in the immigration debate, wherein it's sort of all or nothing. But I think the fact is what would work with our economy, what would work in, again, maximizing American liberty would be to say, wait, we're going to very much constrict citizenship to a merit-based system, much like what you see in Canada or what you see in Australia. But on the temporary workforce, we're going to actually open up the pipe. But that does not seem to be the compromise ground that we're on right now. And so it's constriction of both. And I think it ultimately will prove problematic in terms of basic needs that have to get done in our country.
The Republican switch on their opinions with respect to trade, with respect to immigration, with respect to their opinion of Vladimir Putin, for example, have all shifted dramatically just in the last few years. Were those always fairly weakly held positions? Should I not take Republicans very seriously when they say they stand for the rule of law and free trade and low spending and taxes?
No, but you should recognize that the 80-20 rule exists in politics, which is 20% of the folks drive most of the debates, and that's from the left and from the right, when people have strongly held and articulated positions that they vehemently try and advance. But the middle of the bell curve is just the middle of the bell curve, and it's true in a political body just as it's true in any other large grouping of folks, and they're followers. And there are a lot of followers in Congress that frankly just want to have a good day, and they don't want the president tweeting against them. And if the president is this outspoken, and he's certainly got a strong personality about issue X, Y, and Z, I think I'll just be quiet. But quiet in this sense is deadly, because some of what the president has proposed is in some cases crazy, and in some cases dumb, and in some cases I think dangerous to the notion of preserving American liberty or expanding it. And so I think that, you know, all of us, it's incumbent upon all of us, democracy is not a spectator sport, for all of us to make our voices heard on the importance of dollars staying in our pocketbook or wallet, as the case might be, and adherence to some of the institutions that have served our country awfully, awfully well, because that notion of checks and balances was part and parcel to what the Founding Fathers set up.
Mark Sanford is a Republican representing the 1st Congressional District in South Carolina. We spoke Friday. Please take a moment to rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.